It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon. I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. Today, we turn our attention to self-improvement books, self-development, books that build and inspire, enlighten and ignite, shelf improvement, if you will. These are the books that promise better habits, calmer minds, stronger boundaries, deeper purpose, improved mornings, and occasionally a completely transformed life before breakfast. And yes, I know the genre has its cliches. In fact, I had somebody stop me in the street and say, "Why are you doing a show on self-development books? I'm not really into the genre, but I love the show so much I'm going to listen anyway." Well, I hope I won't disappoint you, because although there are ridiculously and unrealistic bold promises in some of the books, there are superficial five-step formulas, life-changing secrets. But beneath the noise, there are some really thoughtful, rigorous, generous minds trying to help us think more clearly, live more intentionally, and take responsibility for our inner world. It's about asking the right questions, working on the right things, about noticing our patterns, building tools. It's what we all want for ourselves. And there's very good reason why this is the biggest selling section in nonfiction, in bookstores around the world and at home. The only section that actually beats self-help is romance. And we'll talk about that next week. When I was 12, I read a book called Bus 9 to Paradise. You may know it. It was Leo Buscaglia. He was dubbed as Dr. Love at the time. He was the man who used to start all his presentations wearing his jacket, because his mother said that if you're not wearing a jacket, no one takes you seriously. Leo Buscaglia was a phenomenon. And he wrote a book called Bus 9 to Paradise, asking if you can take a bus to paradise. And the premise was that life is a paradise for those who love many things with passion. These days, it's a given, almost part of everyone's lexicon and belief, that you can choose happiness and you can choose to be joyful. But back in the 80s, this was revolutionary. And it was a life-changing idea for me, and something that has informed the rest of my life. Have you got a book that literally changed your life? A book that offered a new way of thinking or of living your life or approaching your life differently? I'd love to hear. Let me know on the SMS line 061-895-1019. So let's get into the books. The first is The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. 8 million copies sold worldwide. It's still on the top five bestsellers for 2025. We're going to delve a little deeper after the ads.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. We're talking about The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins, and you may have wondered why a book that was published now 2-3 years ago is still topping the charts. And that's because millions of readers, and that's no exaggeration, have found her theory to be life-changing. It's a step-by-step guide on how to stop letting other people's opinions, drama, and judgment impact your life. And the two simple words, let them, will set you free from that exhausting cycle of trying to manage everything and everyone around you. Mel Robbins is an Ivy League educated criminal defense attorney and entrepreneur. So she's got the gift of the gab, and she's got a quick wit and insight. And that's really what's made her a global phenomenon in publishing and beyond. She's got a podcast, the Mel Robbins podcast, and you can get a feel for how she really owns her words, her thoughts, and the clarity of her thinking. Reading a book by Mel feels like you are debriefing with a good friend and a glass of wine. And using the same no-nonsense, science-backed approach that made the Mel Robbins podcast such a sensation, she explains why the Let Them Theory is already loved by millions and how you can apply it in 8 key areas of your life to make the biggest impact. Now, the idea that you've been wasting energy trying to control the wrong things, things beyond your control at work, in relationships, and in pursuing your goals, and that this is keeping you from happiness and success, is not new. I'm sure this sounds familiar to you. Philosophers like the Stoics and many others, countless others, have articulated this concept for centuries. Personal peace comes from accepting what is, controlling what you can, and then letting go of the rest. For me, what makes all the difference in Mel Robbins' version, though, is 3 words and let me that she bolts onto the let them phrase. It changes everything. Letting go is hard, sometimes really hard, sometimes impossible. You'll know how difficult that can be. And you'll also be familiar with the pointless ruminations of thoughts that go round and round in your head, seemingly with no end. Why I found Robbins' 5-word mantra, let them and let me, so effective, is that in one pithy phrase that you can repeat to yourself and hear in your head, that on repeat is something useful. It shifts you from perseverating to ideating, from counterproductive inward thoughts that swirl endlessly like the rinse cycle in your head, I know you know what I mean, to something more expansive and constructive. At its best, it moves you to positive action. What am I going to do practically right now to create my dream, the best version of myself, no matter what is happening around me? What do I want to make happen? What is my next step in making a dream come true? It's about granting yourself agency. It's pipped as a life-changing tool, and I think while it may have its caveats and limitations, I do agree. Now, Mel Robbins has been criticized for plagiarizing the term the Let Them Theory. In fact, there's been conversations online and everywhere else whether you can trademark a phrase like let them or the let them theory. The original words, they say, were lifted from a poem, a 2022 poem called written by Cassie Phillips. And they're still knee deep in the legal furore, and we wait to see what happens, because it is interesting to consider if a phrase can be trademarked. Now, Mel Robbins rubs shoulder to shoulder with a book called Atomic Habits by James Clear. And this book is even older than the Mel Robbins theory, but it's still topping not just the top 5, but really the top 3 in Christmas sales for last year. It sold over 25 million copies worldwide as of mid-2025, and it's been translated into more than 60 languages. And what is incredible about it, it's about transforming your life with tiny changes in behavior, starting now. We all think that if you want to change your life, you need to think big. But James Clear discovered that real change comes from the compound effect of hundreds of small decisions. And it's so doable and so practical. And yes, indeed, life-changing. And I think that's why it remains as a top seller throughout the world. Another book that's causing a bit of a sensation is called Mattering by Jennifer Breeny Wallace. What does it take to thrive? Not just achieve, but genuinely flourish in our work and our relationships. High achievement is often held up as the ultimate goal, but as many of you know from lived experience, achievement alone does not guarantee thriving. Jennifer Breeny Wallace is an award-winning journalist and author of various books, and her work explores why high-performing individuals and communities are struggling and what truly allows people to do well under pressure. She focused on a lot of her research studies students attending high achieving schools who were newly identified as being at risk for anxiety and depression. And she reports that what it boiled down to, she said, was mattering. Mattering is a basic fundamental need, like food, like shelter, that researchers have been studying since the 1980s. It's the feeling of feeling valued and having an opportunity to add your value to the world. So it's those twin things, the feeling of feeling valued and having an opportunity to add value to the world. The young people that she researched were doing very well despite intense pressure. And the ones that did succeed felt they mattered for who they were deep at their core, away from their achievements. But what surprised Jennifer was how often the adults in those students' lives felt the opposite. So many adults, she says, in their lives felt like they didn't matter. Parents, caregivers, and professionals spending long days in environments where they felt replaceable or invisible. And she asks, she says, how can parents show up as the first responders to their kids' struggles if they are spending 8, 10, sometimes 12 hours a day in work environments where they are chronically made to feel like they don't matter? And the truth is, they can't. So if we want to solve for the youth mental health crisis, she says, to even make a dent in it, we have to go upstream and take care of the adults in their lives. And so what surprised Jennifer most was not that achievement culture creates pressure, but that sustainable achievement depends on mattering. I liked how she closes the book, because she says, if Jennifer could leave us with one image, she says, imagine everyone you meet, strangers, colleagues, friends, and acquaintances, wear a sign around their neck that says, tell me, do I matter? You can answer that question with a smile, with warmth, with presence. And just as importantly, Wallace cautions us to notice when we intentionally signal the opposite. Be mindful of the mattering energy you're putting out there. For readers of Brené Brown, David Brooks, Adam Grant, Mattering is a rare cultural shifting book that offers both a diagnosis and a remedy. Do you have a book that you have read that has given you a life-changing tool or completely changed the way you think? Let me know on the SMS line 061-895-1019.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. Now, before we begin the conversation today, I want to introduce my guest. Claudia is a social worker. She's a therapist. She has years and years of experience sitting in that most fascinating of places, the place where people tell the truth about their lives. And day after day, she's listened to the patterns that shape us, the relationships we repeat, the stories we tell ourselves, the way we sabotage our own happiness. Sometimes the quiet courage it takes to change. But I would like to introduce Claudia as first a colleague, first an acquaintance, I suppose, a colleague and a friend, and now most importantly, an author. So, Claudia, welcome to the show with your many hats.
Thank you so much, Batya. I'm really delighted to be with you, and thank you for inviting me.
Your book is called The Joy of Being Wrong. And before we went on air, Claudia and I were discussing both our own life choices where we had to admit being wrong and the tremendous joy and meaning and depth that has come from that decision. So I so appreciate you giving me the words to articulate that particular way of living my life. You are famous for this. Before you reach West Park, you must have changed your mind about at least one thing. If you have changed your mind, by at least for at least one thing, please let me know. I would love to hear on the SMS line 061 895 1019. So Claudia's book is called The Joy of Being Wrong, A Pathway to Happiness. And it's a deep well of insight, blending wisdom with the consulting room, with stories from her own life and her travels. It's about relationships, it's about self-understanding, and the extraordinary freedom that can come when we loosen the grip of stories we've carried for years. And so today I want to explore a few of these ideas, the love, the communication, the idea of martyr. Claudia, first, I know how personal this book was for you. It weaves together your own journey of questioning, of traveling, of searching alongside the stories with your clients. What was the moment you decided that this is the moment to write the book? And what did it reveal about your own life? Because it's not like you didn't live a self-aware life. You were living what you were preaching. You were walking your talk. But the book must have given you something else.
Indeed. The book was written in 6 months, but actually was sitting in my head or on my shoulders as a nudge for about 7 years, actually. So I thought about the book and discussed it with my late husband because I was very excited to share a lot of my ideas that I could see were working well with my clients. And so I was making notes, but to be honest, I never could really get going. And I kept notes, I did voice notes, I did my best. Okay, so I'm in the right place. Sorry about the noise. Okay.
We can barely hear it. Claudia is in a mamad in Ranana, so you will excuse if there is some ambient noise, but we can barely hear it. If you're able to concentrate, we would love to hear what you can say.
Thank goodness I'm a very good multitasker. So as I was saying, the book actually, and I'm just going to inform my family so that they're not worried that I'm actually in the shelter.
Of course.
If you give me one moment. Okay. Because that's what we do. We just inform each other that we're safe. Okay. Of course, it had to be now. Okay. So I thought about the book a lot. And I think, Batya, what's so important is because I could see it working with my clients, I felt quite frustrated that I was limited to a few people because I knew that what I had to share was so important. And not for any other reason, but I'm a firm believer that if I understand that something works well, I love to share it. I'm quite generous like that. In fact, even with my recipes, I often used to stand at Spa in Norwood and someone would say, why are you buying cheese? And I'd say, I'm making a cheesecake. And they go, oh, great. Have you got the recipe? And I'd give the recipe. So
I hope you didn't change an ingredient when you gave that recipe. Never.
Never, because I really do believe in sharing and especially things that are, you know, that are good and work. And after my late husband passed away and I was sitting with this book and sitting with it and I felt very beholden to him because he was a journalist and he wrote a lot. And he often said to me, come on, get going with the book. And Batya, there was something inside of me that just wouldn't move. And so when I sold up and closed my practice and traveled for a year, I knew instinctively the reason I couldn't write the book is that I hadn't yet understood the full extent of what it meant to be wrong and find joy. I knew where I was wrong, but I hadn't found the joy because I'd gone through so much loss, losing my husband, my mother 10 weeks later, living on my own through COVID. And there was so much loss that I thought to myself, how can I talk about the joy? Because I haven't yet experienced it about being wrong. Hmm. And so even when I went to write the book in France, and I just met somebody who today is my present husband, I suddenly understood, okay, I'm not standing on a soapbox. I'm not talking theory. I've actually allowed myself to feel again, feel in a different way, enjoy a partnership in a different way, and believe that I don't have to be this self-sufficient person soldiering on. And then the book came, and then the book flowed. And then I understood the timing of everything. I only could write the book when I understood deeply the title that had been sitting in my head for maybe 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, it's almost like the joy, as you say, the joy part had to come first.
Yes.
Exactly. You got the wrong part and you got that. And I think that it's natural, because many of us look at decisions we've made and it's kind of easy in hindsight to see where we went wrong. Perhaps the harder part then is to do 180 degrees from that point and say, okay, what are we going to now create to bring joy and meaning and life, you know, into what we got wrong. It's very powerful. Your book gives some tools to do that, I hope.
Lots. In fact, everybody laughs and says, Claudia, the first 50 pages were amazing and easy. I said, yes, that's because you were reading about my life.
It wasn't the work.
And then the rest of it was about doing the work for your life. And that's where people go, yeah, I'll come back to it. Yeah, I'll come back to it. And I said, well, the good thing is, it's like a classic. You can always come back to it. It's not a trendy book that is going to wear out or be out of fashion. You know, it's something that you can have on your shelf forever. Would you mind if I just clarified one thing, which is absolutely crucial to understanding the words, the title of being wrong, because most people think it's about making an error, you know, choosing the wrong house or making a poor decision or doing the wrong thing and forgiving yourself because you did the wrong thing. It's a lot deeper than that. It's actually about understanding that you've walked around your whole life with a very powerful cornerstone of thought and belief, like it's a man's world, or I have to do everything myself, or I can't trust people around me, or anything like that. And people don't understand that they live by that credo. They live by that blueprint. And so the joy of being wrong is actually about allowing yourself to be wrong about your presumptions, about your beliefs and your attitudes. And that's really what it's about being wrong about. It's not about a mistake, because as a child, it's definitely not a mistake to make those conclusions. It actually gives you a sense of direction, and it looks after you in a very protective way to have those presumptions. Unfortunately, people walk around with, which is how I describe it in the book, with Windows 65, 1965 in their brain instead of 2026. And so people walk around with childhood decisions that they never update. And that's the essence of the book. It's about updating.
Sure. Yes, it does sound like a lot of work. And for some, and when you're strong enough to do it, it's most welcome. For others, it's rather daunting. But I think either way, for me, the skills, the very specific tools you give have been so helpful. One of the one that stands out for me is the idea of being able to control only two things. And you say two things in your book, but I'd like to give it a caveat. You say it's our health and our communication. But I would like to add, if I may, and say it is our health, but then it's self-awareness first to know what you need, and then the communication to express what you need. But I'd love you to unpack that.
Sure. And I'm going to, in fact, I spoke about this the other day because I was talking to people who are undergoing enormous stress. And I said, it's the same thing. That you always have to remember what you can control and what you can't. Because sadly, people spend an enormous amount of time in their lives worrying about things they have no control over. And then they leave very little energy for the things they actually do have control over. So the first thing I mention is health, because I do believe that to a large degree, we do and we can manage our health ourselves. In other words, exercise, nutrition, sleep. And when we get up in the morning and our throat is sore, to say, okay, maybe there's something I can't say or something I'd like to say. You know, I'm a big believer in Louise Hayes.
Me too.
And of course, I like to check in with my body every day. And let me tell you, Batya, my body's given me a lot of information in the last 64 years that I am so grateful for, because I do listen to my body intently. And I try and nip it in the bud early. So I think, first of all, if we prepare to see our body as not letting us down, but actually an extension of what's happening inside of us, we can control a lot by looking after ourselves and taking note of it. The second part, which is the communication, is based in divided under two sections. It's what I share with you and what I ask from you. So yes, you're correct that you have to have awareness. I like to use the word also responsibility. You'll note in my book that I use the word responsibility a lot of the time. And my clients roll their eyes when I say to them, if you want to be in therapy, you've got to be responsible. I don't do victims. The only victims are children. Adults are not victims. And if you want to be responsible, it's an exciting journey. And to go back to your word that you said, of, you know, it's daunting and it's hard work. I never use the word hard work for one reason. Do you know how much energy goes into keeping yourself negative? Do you know how much energy goes into keeping your presumptions going? It's a full-time job. It's a full-time job being miserable, and it's a full-time job being a yes, but person. So actually, it's freeing to say, you know what? What do I feel and what are my options, and to exercise them. So going back to the control over what I choose to say to you, it can be simple, like, Batya, when I'm sick, I like to be left alone. That's information. Or when I'm sick, I like to be cherished and looked after. Please make me a cup of tea, or please come and visit me, or please message me. And what I ask from you and what I share with you is completely up to me. People instead focus on, but what happens if she says this? And what happens if he doesn't reply? And people unfortunately want a guarantee on the response. And my point is, as long as you're in charge of what you're offering in an adult way, in other words, in a responsible way, the response is actually sometimes irrelevant. Because regret is probably the hardest thing that human beings have to live with. And if you ask most people, when they're dying, they'll talk about the regrets of what they didn't say to loved ones, not what they didn't do. And that's why, for me, communication is so crucial in terms of our sense of control.
You call it signposting, and yes, it has been a magic word for me. Personally, I have used that in a very difficult relationship with someone close to me, who, it's not an ideal relationship, and it's still not an ideal relationship. But by me communicating exactly what I need the response to be, or what kind of support I require at certain times, I feel mm-hmm. that it has built the relationship to the best that it can be. So I'm very grateful.
Mm. Yes. And what you've realized is that giving signposts, which is for the listener right now, when we're driving on the highway, we are so reassured when we see that there's a gas station in a kilometer and we need petrol, or we need to go to the loo, or that we want reassurance of how far the next destination is. And in relationships, people leave clues. They're not specific. And so women are famous for this, or should I say notorious. Women would rather say, but he should have just known. Women like to think that men should just know what they want. And they think if they're specific, it's not romantic and it's not great. It's not fabulous love. But actually giving people information is the most important thing, Batya, for one reason. You're not setting them up to fail you. And I like giving people the best option to win. And so when you tell someone, I'm not going to answer my phone while I'm writing exams, on holiday I switch off, so I'm not going to send you a million photographs, please be with me right now, I need support. Those are the kinds of things that give people tremendous security because they know that they're going to get it right. And that's why I do love signposting, and I'm so glad that it's helped you with this relationship.
The other thing that I really believe in, and you mentioned Louise Hay, and I do, it really does work for me. I have a tell. If I'm overwhelmed, I get a tell. I get a stinging kind of feeling in my lower back. It's very specific. It's an alarm clock for me to slow down, to quieten down, and to reframe my load. And I've learned to listen to it, because when I ignore it, I either get weepy or inappropriate, or I get flu, and it just escalates. So I've learned when I get that feeling, it's panado, it's cancel the afternoon, it's quietly sitting, reading my book, filling my cup. And it's very helpful to know that about yourself.
Absolutely. So what you've identified is that you are willing to do something called early warning signals. And the body does give us early warning signals. Nobody just wakes up one day with pneumonia. Nobody just wakes up one day with a huge autoimmune diagnosis. We get a lot of clues along the way, which sadly we try and ignore or suppress. So your back, which is your whole area of your structure, your spine, of how you carry yourself in life, and your sense of burden and your sense of security, gives you a very quick twinge to say, hold on a minute, maybe you're not supporting yourself. And then you take care of it, which means you and your body are really working well together. So that's an excellent example.
I guess the trick with all these things, and I'm sure you see this in therapy all the time, you can give insight, you can give direction, but that doesn't alone lead to change. In your experience, what helps people cross the floor, as one of your clients called it? How do you begin to live differently once you made a decision to do so?
Well, so let me answer you like this. It's a strange thing to say as a therapist, but essentially people don't want to change. That's the truth. And because I accept that, that's how I can work with people without getting frustrated or angry. That's why I'm not a rescuer, because I do understand the resistance to change. And I don't make it my business to obsess about it or try and convert people. Because if you do, you get hooked and then you become a rescuer. So what I do understand is that there's a small part of you that always wants something different, but a big part of you that shuts it down by saying, it's not going to work. He'll be like this. Why am I doing it? Better the devil you know, and so on. So the trick is to try and change the proportion a little bit at a time. So one of the things that I encourage, certainly with my clients, is to start with things that are innocuous, Batya. Don't start with big relationships. Don't start with big leaps and bounds. Start with small things. Do you know, an example is when you started driving, you and I, there was no such thing as Waze. There was no such thing as, So we could either write down from a map which way to go. But my favorite thing was, sometimes I would just turn left when I knew I needed to turn right, just to see the different route of getting somewhere. And I've said that to people in therapy, do one thing different this week. If you were going to do something, if you were going to not call someone because you were cross with them, just decide to approach it differently. In other words, choose one small item to try and change so that you don't overload yourself, you don't overwhelm yourself with too much pressure. And try. It's like walking into a warehouse. You go, oh my God, there's too much to do. And I always say, start with your side drawer next to your bed. That's a bit, which is always a nightmare. It's a nightmare drawer, always is. But I always say, just start with a drawer. So the first thing with people is start with small, manageable items to encourage your optimism or your faith that actually things can be done differently. And the other thing to do with people is to give examples. So for me, in my practice, I often used examples. So there's something called empathy that I understood why the person was resisting, and I gave them examples. Like I called it little moments of hope from other people's stories so that they could believe, because you know, Batya, the power of self-help is that if other people are going through something, I'll believe it more than my therapist is telling me.
Right.
So the fear of change is so anticipated that, funnily enough, when people start doing small acts of change, they realize it's never as bad as they thought, which then helps them with momentum. And then finally, one of the important things to understand, which is one of the theories I never forgot from university, because I certainly forgot a lot because they never resonated with me, was ripples, pull and push belief, which is you've got to be partially uncomfortable and partially motivated. If you are too uncomfortable, you'll be paralyzed. If you're too motivated, you won't bother. So you've got to be partially uncomfortable and partially motivated, and then that's the ideal. Unfortunately, how do most people change, Batya? Through crisis and illnesses.
Yeah.
That's most of the time what is the catalyst of change in most people's lives.
Yeah. I know all about that, house fires and all.
Exactly.
But I think I suppose as long as the change comes, and what did you say? It's part
discomfort and partial motivation.
I'm gonna think about that. I think that's what's gonna keep me up tonight.
Yeah.
You've worked for decades with clients in therapy. Writing a book is very different. And what do you most hope that readers will get from this book?
I hope that readers will get a sense of hope. And I hope that I also want my, it's not that I'm a optimistic person as such, but I believe very much that people deep down are good and often lose their way. That people get distracted and waylaid and go down a rabbit hole, that sometimes they get lost. And if some of my words can just help somebody get out of that hole and get back on track, I think it's a marvelous thing when you know that you've made impact and a difference to another person's life in a small way or a big way. And so I love it when I hear people write to me and say, you know, there was a section in your book, you were talking directly to me and I was sitting on your couch. And so for me, the ongoing sense of reciprocity and mutuality that I gain from working with people is my fuel and my faith. And I love the fact that I can work with people and make a difference. Not in a way of being not a guru, but working with people that they find their own sense of purpose. And so I really am hoping that my book rubs off on people in the way that they find their hope and faith again.
Claudia, if listeners want a piece of your fuel, your faith and the Claudia magic in a book, where can they find your book?
So in South Africa, my book is actually in Exclusive Books and some Estoril branches, and it is online with Takealot. And I'm not sure about how many people order on Amazon, but I'm also on Amazon, Kindle and hard copy.
Okay, so easy peasy. There is nothing standing in the way of you getting a little piece of this motivation, discomfort, hope, and so much more. Claudia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
It's been a pleasure, and stay safe.
Thank you. Really, really wonderful seeing you and being with you today. Missed you a lot.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricka.
And welcome back. I'm Batya Bricka, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark. I've saved the best for last. This book is called 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. It was an instant Sunday Times bestseller. And in my opinion, I think it is the best in a genre on the shelves at the moment. I have read it cover to cover twice, and it is full of sticker tags all over the place for me to reread when I get a chance. The premise is this. The average human lifespan, that's yours and mine, is absurdly, outrageously, and insultingly brief. If you live to 80, you have about 4,000 weeks on Earth. For some of us, we're going to live longer, given the longevity stats at the moment, but not many more weeks than 4,000. So how should we best use them? Of course, nobody needs telling that there isn't enough time. We're obsessed by our lengthening to-do lists, our overfilled inboxes, the struggle against distraction, and the sense that our attention spans are shriveling. But we rarely make the conscious connection that these problems only trouble us in the first place, thanks to the ultimate time management problem, the challenge of how best to use our 4,000 weeks. And I'm going to read a little bit from the book to give you a sense of the wisdom that is really pretty much, every sentence is riven with gold, one of the commentators say, and I think I agree. To make time for what matters, you need to give things up. Convenience culture seduces us into imagining that we might find room for everything important by eliminating only life's tedious tasks, and that we manage our time well. But it's a lie. You have to choose. You have to choose a few things, sacrifice everything else, and deal with the inevitable sense of loss that results. 4,000 Weeks is an uplifting, engrossing, and deeply realistic exploration of this problem. And what he does, he draws on philosophy, on literature, and psychology, delving into ideas like time, because time is a human construct, so we've really created the problem we have now. And he covers the past, the present, and the future, and our battles with time. It goes beyond practical tips, and its many revelations will transform your view. It certainly did mine. I'll read you another bit from his book, and it's called Facing Finitude is the name of this chapter. And he says, as I make hundreds of small choices throughout the day, I'm building a life, but at one and at the same time, I'm closing off the possibility of countless others forever. The original Latin word for decide, decidere, means to cut off, as if in slicing away alternatives. And it's a close cousin of words like homicide or suicide. Any finite life, even the best one you could possibly imagine, is a matter of ceaselessly waving goodbye to possibility. And I think we all have to face that. Drawing on the insights of ancient philosophers, of Benedictine monks, artists, authors, Scandinavian social reformers, renegade Buddhist technologists, and many others, he sets out to realign our relationship with time, and in so doing, to liberate us from its grasp. This book is a celebration of everything that is human. It's called 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. And I strongly suggest that not only do you get the book, but you start considering your 4,000 weeks and how you wish to spend them. I hope you have enjoyed today's show. We explored the books that make you ask the right questions, make the right adjustments, and hopefully put you on the right path. Join me next week for a show all about love, that most written about, sung about, dreamed about force in human history, all its different kinds, from the deep, meaningful forever love, the love as an invisible thread through a historical drama, the uber-trendy mashup genre that we're now seeing on our shelves of romanticy, and the rom-com, light and frothy and pure escapism. Join me on Friday the 21st of March for the next episode of Bookmark, called The Language of Love. For now, goodbye and happy reading.